Chapter 2. The police in Zurich, Schwartz went on, held me for only one day. But it was a hard day for me. I was afraid they would check my passport. A phone call to Vienna would be enough, or if they called in a specialist, he would discover the alterations. In the afternoon, I calmed down. Whatever happened, it seemed to me, would be a kind of divine judgment. The decision was out of my hands. If they put me in prison, I'd have to abandon my idea of going to Germany. But late that afternoon, they let me out, giving me to understand that I should leave Switzerland as quickly as possible. I decided to go by way of Austria. I had some familiarity with the Austrian border and felt sure it would not be as closely guarded as that of Germany proper. Actually, why should either border be closely guarded? Who wanted to get in? But on the other hand, there were probably a good many wanting to get out. I took the train to Oberried, planning to attempt the crossing somewhere in the vicinity. I'd have liked best to wait for a rainy day, but for 2 days the sky was clear. I left the third night, for fear that too long a stay would attract attention. The stars were all out that night, and it was so still that I seemed to hear the plants growing. In times of danger, a different form of sight sets in. It's not a special focusing of the eyes, but something that spreads all over the body, as if you could see with your skin, especially at night. Your hearing moves into your skin, too, and you seem to see the slightest sound. You open your mouth and listen, and your mouth, too, seems to see and to hear. I shall never forget that night. I was alert in every fiber. All my senses were wide awake. I was prepared for anything, but utterly without fear. I felt as though I were crossing a high bridge from one side of my life to the other, and I knew that the bridge would fade away behind me like silvery smoke, and that I'd never be able to return. I was passing from reason to feeling, from security to adventure, from rationality to dream. I was utterly alone, but this time my solitude was not a torment. There was something mystical about it. I came to the Rhine, which is young at this spot and not very wide. I undressed and made a bundle of my clothes so as to hold them over my head. It was a weird feeling when I slipped naked into the water. It was black and very cool and strange. I felt I was plunging into the River Lethe to drink forgetfulness. It struck me as symbolic that I had to pass through it naked, as though leaving everything behind me. I dried myself, dressed, and continued on my way. Passing near a village, I heard a dog bark. I didn't know exactly how the border ran, so I kept to the edge of a road that skirted a forest. For a long while, I met no one. I walked until dawn. A heavy dew was falling, and there was a stag standing at the edge of a clearing. I went on until I heard peasants driving their wagons. Then I looked for a hiding place not far from the road. I was afraid of arousing suspicion by being up so early and coming from the direction of the border. Later, I saw two customs guards on bicycles. I recognized their uniforms. I was in Austria. Austria had belonged to Germany for just 1 year. The woman in evening dress left the terrace with her escort. Her shoulders were very tan, and she was taller than the man who was with her. A few other tourists sauntered slowly down the steps. They all walked like people who had never been hunted, without looking around. I had some sandwiches, said Schwartz, and there was a brook to drink from. At noon I went on. My goal was the town of Feldkirch, which I knew to be a resort where a stranger would not attract attention. When I got there, I took the first train out of the dangerous border zone. I stepped into a compartment. Two uniformed SA men were sitting there. My experience with the police forces of Europe stood me in good stead, or I might have retreated. As it was, I went in and sat down in a corner next to a man in a Loden suit, with a gun propped up beside him. It was my first encounter in 5 years with everything that to me was the essence of horror. In the preceding weeks, I had often imagined this scene, but the reality was different. It was my body, not my head, that reacted. My stomach turned to stone. My mouth felt like a grater. The hunter and the SA men were talking about a widow Funder. She seemed to be the merry variety of widow, to judge by the love affairs they detailed. After a while, they began to eat ham sandwiches. "Where are you headed for, neighbor?" the hunter asked me. "Back to Bregenz," I said. "You seem to be a stranger here." "Yes, I'm on my vacation."
"And where have you come from?"
I hesitated for a moment. If I had said Vienna, as indicated in my passport, they might have noticed that I didn't speak the soft Viennese dialect. "From Hanover," I said. "I've been living there more than 30 years.
"Hanover? Whew, that's a long way."
"Yes, it's quite a way, but who wants to spend his vacation near home?" The hunter laughed.
"That's a fact. You've been lucky with the weather."
I felt my shirt sticking to my back. "Yes, it's been marvelous, but it's as hot as midsummer." The three of them started in again on the Widow Funder. A few stations later, they got out, and I was left alone in the compartment. The train was passing through one of the most beautiful countrysides in Europe, but I saw very little of it. I was overcome by an almost intolerable feeling of regret, fear, and despair. Why on earth had I crossed the border? It was beyond me. I sat motionless in my corner, staring out the window. I was a prisoner, and I myself had allowed the lock to snap shut. I kept thinking I'd leave the train and try to get back to Switzerland during the night. But I didn't. My left hand clutched the late Schwartz's passport in my pocket, as though it might give me strength. I kept telling myself that by now it would do me no good to get out, and that the farther inland I went, the safer I'd be. I decided to travel through the night. In trains, you're not so likely to be asked for your papers as in hotels. When you're in a panic, you always feel that a spotlight is on you, that no one has anything else to do but search for you. I closed my eyes. The temptation to give in to my panic was still greater because I was alone in the compartment. But I knew that every inch I gave now would become a yard when I should really be in danger. I told myself that no one was looking for me, that I was of no more interest to the regime than a shovelful of sand in the desert, and that there was nothing visibly suspicious about me. This was true, of course. I looked hardly any different from the people around me. The blonde Aryan is a German legend. Take a look at Hitler, Goebbels, Hess, and the rest of the leaders, all of them living disproof of their own delusions. In Munich, I left the shelter of the railroad stations for the first time and forced myself to take an hour's walk. Not knowing the city, I felt sure that no one would know me. I stopped to eat at the Franziskanerbrau. The place was full. I sat down alone and listened. A few minutes later, a stout, perspiring man took a seat at my table. He ordered beer and boiled beef and unfolded a newspaper. So far, it hadn't occurred to me to read the German papers. Now I bought two of them. I hadn't read German for years, and it still seemed strange to hear everyone talking it around me. The editorials were abominable, packed with bloodthirsty, arrogant lies. The whole outside world was represented as degenerate, treacherous, stupid, and good for nothing else but to be taken over by Germany. These were not small local papers. They had formerly enjoyed a good reputation. I studied the man at my table. He ate, drank, and read with pleasure. I looked around. Many of the diners were reading papers, and in none of them did I detect any sign of distaste. This had become their daily fare. It seemed just as natural to them as their beer. I continued to read until, among the short news items, I found one about Osnabrück. A house on Lutherstrasse had burned down. I could see the street clearly. It began outside the ramparts, at Hager Gate, and led away from the city. I suddenly felt lonelier than I ever had in a foreign country. My state of mind fluctuated between shock and fatalistic apathy, but soon I got used to it. I even began to feel safe. The danger would increase as I approached Osnabrück, that I knew. There would be people who remembered me from the old days. To avoid attracting attention at hotels, I bought a cheap suitcase and the usual articles required for a short trip. Then I took the train. I still didn't know how I was going to get in touch with my wife and changed my plans every few minutes. I would have to trust to chance. I didn't even know whether she had given in to her family, staunch supporters of the regime, and married someone else. After reading the papers, I wasn't so sure that it would take an average mortal very long before believing what he read, especially when there was no possibility of comparison. Foreign papers were strictly censored in Germany. In Münster, I went to an average hotel. I couldn't go on staying up at night and sleeping here and there in the daytime. I had to take the risk of staying in a hotel, where my arrival would be reported to the police. "Do you know Münster?" "A little," I said. "Isn't it an old city with a lot of churches, where the Treaty of Westphalia was signed?" Schwartz nodded. "In Münster and Osnabrück in 1648, after 30 years of war. Who knows how long this one will last?" "Not very long if it goes on like this. It took the Germans only 4 weeks to conquer France." The waiter came and said the place was closing, that everyone else had left. "Isn't there some other place that's still open?" Schwartz asked. There wasn't much nightlife in Lisbon, the waiter told us, but when Schwartz gave him a tip, he knew of a place, very secret, he said, a Russian nightclub. "Very chic." "Will they let us in?" I asked. "Of course they will, sir. I just meant that the ladies who go there are chic. All nationalities, Germans, too." "How long does it stay open?" "As long as there are customers. At this time of night, there are always customers. Lots of Germans right now."
"What kind of Germans?"
"Germans. With money?" "Of course," the waiter laughed. "The place isn't cheap, but very entertaining. Just say that Manuel sent you. Then you won't have to tell them anything else."
"Do you usually have to tell them something?"
"No. The doorman makes out a membership card for you with an imaginary name. Just a formality."
"Sounds all right."
Schwartz paid the check. We went slowly down the street with the stairs. As though leaning on each other's shoulders, the pale houses slept. Through the windows you could hear the moaning, snoring, and breathing of people without passport troubles. Our footfalls sounded louder than in the daytime.
"The lights," said Schwartz. "Do they startle you, too?"
"Yes, we're still used to blacked-out Europe. I keep thinking somebody has forgotten to turn them off, and the planes will attack any minute."
Schwartz stopped.
Light was given to us as a gift from God, he said with emotion, because there is something of God in us, and now we hide it, because we are murdering the bit of God in us. As I remember the story, I said, the gods didn't make man a gift of fire. Prometheus stole it. In return, the gods gave him chronic cirrhosis of the liver. Schwartz looked at me. I stopped joking long ago. As long as people joke, they belittle the proportions of things. Perhaps, I said, but isn't that better if it lets in a ray of hope? You're right. I forgot that you were trying to get away. How can a man who's trying to get away have time to think of proportions? Aren't you trying to get away too? Schwartz shook his head. Not anymore. I'm going back. Where? I asked in amazement. I couldn't believe that he meant to go back to Germany a second time.